Hello and welcome to Infinite Machine Learning. This is your host, Prateek Joshi. In each episode of this podcast, we talk to an amazing AI founder or a VC and dive deep into a specific topic. Today, we have Varun Mohan on the show. He is the co-founder and CEO of Codeium, an AI code generation tool used by hundreds of thousands of developers. They recently announced their $65 million Series B, led by Kleiner Perkins, with participation from Green Oaks and General Catalyst. He was previously at Nuro working on autonomous cars, and he has a bachelor's and master's degree from MIT. Today's episode is phenomenal. Varun has sharp opinions, pointed opinions, and he just gets right in. It's going to be a brilliant episode. All right, ready for liftoff? And 3, 2, 1. Let's go! Varun, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hey Prateek, how's it going?
Let's get right into it. Generative AI for coding, right? It's hot. It's important. Everyone's talking about it. What's the state of play in terms of what it can do well today?
Yeah. So I think you know, over the last, I would say, like, year or two, we've had a lot of truly big breakthroughs, I think, in generative AI, and happy to talk a little bit about what we've been up to. But also at the same time, there's been an incredible amount of, I think, demoware also that has come out in the space. I would say over the last, like, year and a half, we've seen a lot of demos. And I think this has both helped and hurt us as a company. And the demos make it so that, look, the space can do basically anything. And which is exciting because we have a product, and that means that people naturally will be more excited about our product. But at the same time, it adds, like, a lot of misinformation about what's actually feasible. And just basic things about the product space. Like, right now, the products that are providing the most value are products like autocomplete, which is basically supercharging developers as they type code, being able to use context from everywhere in the code base. And then chat, that is capable of munging data throughout the code base and providing actionable insights about how you should actually change your code, right? And there's many other things that are sort of coming out, but these are the two proven applications right now of these systems. But last year, we ended up getting a whole host of these agents like, hey, you know, AutoGPT is something that will take your entire code base and generate a bunch of stuff, look on the internet and do a bunch of stuff like that. And realistically, nothing really came of that, despite the fact that the technology was GPT-4 and all these announcements happened. And I think it will happen at some point. But just in that case, like, this idea of autonomously being able to write an entire PR end to end is something that we have not done in enough domains that it is capable today, right? These models still hallucinate very, very easily. They still make basic bugs. And the approaches that companies have taken to sort of get around this is just write the bugs. And if you can possibly execute the code, keep executing the code until the bugs disappear, right? So have it both generate the code and the test and see if that's actually possible. And in some domains that works, but in really complicated code bases, that just doesn't work. So long answer short, a lot has been possible with tools like autocomplete. Tools like Codeium generate over 50% of all code that people write. But at the same time, some of the stuff of automatically generating PRs, we are a little bit away from doing that at enough scale, I would say.
That's an excellent point. And you used the word demoware, which means, like, it's easy to build a nice, flashy, cool demo. But when it comes to doing real work, like in big enterprise settings and, like, production settings, it falls short. So when you look at the work of building software, all work, right? So what can generative AI do well, reliably, meaning you would say, okay, for these tasks, we can definitely trust generative AI. And also, on the flip side, what are things that these demos have shown, oh my God, it works, but in practice, they fall way short? So maybe, what are the two buckets here?
Yeah. So, okay, here's the thing. I love this, like, a fantastic question. When we think about AI products, I think about them in three categories, okay? Or there are three dimensions that they need to hit. The first thing is quality. Okay. If the quality is not high enough, these products just are not going to be used. And I'll give you an example here. Like, even for autocomplete, with the advent of LLMs, was it only capable for these products to hit high enough acceptance rates that users were even willing to use the product, right? Because if the acceptance rate is too low, if it's like 10%, even if it does give you useful suggestions, it's too noisy. That users, it erodes user trust, right? The second key piece is latency. Okay. If the quality is not great, but the latency is very low, then at least it's interactive. You can keep regenerating it over and over. And autocomplete hits a sweet spot where the quality is, like, not perfect. You're not accepting it all the time, but the latency is so snappy that the user is willing to basically deal with it, right? The user is willing to deal with it. And then the third key piece that I like saying is correctability. If what this thing does is it generates a lot, and even if the latency is low and the quality is high, if it's even wrong like 10, 20% of the time, but the user needs to go in, understand what the AI generated and do all of these other things, the user will expect pristine quality. They will need to assume that it's completely autonomous. And you know, there's an analog, because before this, I worked in self-driving, of why L5 autonomy, which is perfect autonomy, is very hard. Because you can't, there are no edge cases that are feasible, right? In that fully autonomous case. So coming back to what you said, this completely explains how the products that we find the most useful in the code space are those products. Chat, people accept the fact that these systems hallucinate from time to time. And companies like Codeium have been able to fix this with context awareness, fine-tuning the model on your private data and stuff like that. But these systems still hallucinate, right? And the user still needs to review it, ultimately. And I think the reality on the flip side of the products that don't work, actually, Copilot came out with something, GitHub Copilot, a year ago for PR summaries. And what we realized is actually that the PR summary is useful. It is useful to have a PR summary. It's the final step before a PR gets accepted into a company. But the PR summary, on the other hand, it would summarize the code incorrectly. Sometimes it would miss a file. Sometimes it would incorrectly summarize the file with respect to the entire, which is the whole point of it. The whole point is to aid. So it was not, the technology was not good enough to get in a state where it was a useful enough PR summary. And at the same time, on the other hand, if I can just name one thing that they added in there was a haiku. So something that just summarizes it with a poem, but that was very nice to read, but that's not useful to a developer. So there are these two Venn diagram buckets of useful to a developer and technically feasible. And the sweet spot of these products are somewhere in between, and they need to hit this quality, latency, and correctability trade-off for the product to actually have real adoption in the enterprise.
That's a fantastic way of looking at this sector and understanding what's doable. Meaning sometimes you can build cool stuff, but actually, to build a real product, a lot of the practical constraints, as you said, like, yeah, you'll generate a bunch of amazing code, but is that actually usable? Can the developer correct it if needed? Can they accept these suggestions? So I think that's fantastic. Now, maybe it's a good point to stop and talk about Codeium. You know, you're the founder, CEO. For listeners who don't know, can you quickly explain what Codeium does?
Yeah. So maybe I can start with a little bit of backstory of how we got here, because we didn't even start building Codeium. We started with a company that built GPU virtualization technology. So technology to run GPU workloads at scale, and GPU compiler technology. So technology to run these deep learning models even faster. And we were managing upwards of 10,000 GPUs. And sort of what happened was, in the middle of 2022, transformers ended up becoming really popular. And we realized that this would usher in a brand new set of applications. And one of the big applications that we were really excited about was code. And we were early adopters of a product like Copilot, but we thought that this was just the beginning of what the future would look like. So what we decided to do was take our technology and actually vertically integrate it and build out this product called Codeium. But we ended up doing it with a little bit of a twist. We said we'd give the product away entirely for free, which meant that we needed to optimize the infrastructure so much. We needed to train our own models and run them at massive scale. And just some stats, in the beginning of 2023, we had less than 1,000 users. And at the end of 2023, we had over 300,000 users that had used the product. We processed between 50 and 100 billion tokens of code every day, which is between 5 and 10 billion lines of code every day. Codeium is one of the top 5 largest generative AI apps in terms of text in the world. And then also on top of that, when developers use Codeium, over 45% of all software that they write is generated with Codeium. And Codeium offers like a suite of functionality. It offers ultra low latency autocomplete that generates the most amount of software of any tool in the market. It offers chat that is completely contextually aware. And it also lets you make larger scale changes in your code base with operations like command and stuff that is agnostic of what IDE that your company ends up using.
All right. I actually saw when Codeium launched, like on Hacker News, you posted it, and you know, it's a tough crowd, and you're answering questions, and you're like, you're standing up to the crowd. And I mean, new product is always tough. They'll compare you to a $1 trillion company, but I think it was a great launch point, and I'm glad you have come a long way. Now let's dive a level deeper here. So there are so many different programming languages and paradigms. How do you handle that during training? And also, do you need specialized training for each language, each paradigm, each different section of this huge programming universe?
Yeah, so I think two good points that you brought up there. So the first one is actually one of the beautiful things about these LLMs is they're generic learners, actually. So I'll give you an example of what that means. So Rust and C++ are fairly similar languages in some ways. Like Rust might have better memory semantics than C++ does. But what you actually notice is the quality and capability of these models at writing Rust improves as you train it on more C++. Because it's actually able to learn from the semantics of C++ to write better Rust. Just some other piece of detail there. So no, the answer is like a lot of work doesn't need to be put on the most common languages. Like we don't need to do something very bespoke there. But we actually try to make our system work for some of the more bespoke languages, given that we work with enterprises like Verilog, RTL. If you think about languages like COBOL, these are languages that we care about for enterprises. And that is something that we take time with. If I could say one thing that we've had to do outside of the modeling side is making sure that it works across all platforms, right? If you write Windows applications, you will use Visual Studio. If you write Java applications, a lot of companies use JetBrains or Eclipse. And actually, we're the only product on the market that has an Eclipse extension right now. And that's fundamentally because we realize that developers are tied to the platforms that they write in. And our goal here is to supercharge development regardless of where people are. Right. And that was a core tenet of the company. And we came out with the JetBrains product very soon after coming out with the VS Code product.
Right. That's actually a really good point. Meeting developers where they are, where they live, because as developers, once you choose a tool, you'll stick with it for a long time. And they're not going to switch to a new, brand new programming tool just because there's another tool available. So that's it's very interesting. Now, let's talk about the model architectures that are more conducive to building a product like this. Now, you mentioned earlier that LLMs are generic enough that you don't need to do a lot of custom work. Now, can you explain the underlying AI models that are powering this? And also, what parts can be optimized so that when you compare it to generating like normal text versus generating code, what can be sped up, optimized, or made better in general?
Yeah, so I mean the high level answer for some of this of what people are running, they're running autoregressive transformers. So what does that mean? That basically means like you need to pass in a prompt, and this prompt gets processed, and then afterwards it generates one token every step that it runs, and it runs through the entire model. This is actually fairly inefficient, right? In the sense that you need to read all the weights of the model to generate one token. You can process the prompt all in one shot, but you need to every time you do a token. So this means that these models are really efficient in terms of compute utilization if you batch, because you can process many, many prompts at the same time, and you can actually generate, when you generate one token, you can actually do it across many prompts. You can get better compute utilization. These are the kinds of tricks that we've done where how do we actually make sure that we can batch a bunch of these prompts and a bunch of these generations all at the same time while not blowing up the amount of memory usage on these GPUs, because these GPUs don't have a lot of memory on them. Sorry, I'm getting into the weeds here, but these are kind of the architectural decisions you can make on the transformer to make it more conducive to the application. One other thing that really matters is the objective by which you train these models. And I'll tell you, that's like a big change that we sort of had to make, which is that when you're writing code, it's not like chat. There's code underneath you, there's code above you, there's code in other files. And we've made it so that the objective one is good at this objective called filling in the middle, which is filling in code. Most of the time when people write code, they're refactoring code, right? They're not writing net new code, they're taking an existing application and changing it. So for those kinds of applications, we needed to change the pre-training objective, the objective by which we train the model, to actually make it good at that. The same thing is we even need to make the model, I would say, like, better at applying context from other files, right? That isn't a thing that you read a document and you pass it into a data set. It will be good at applying context from other documents. That's something that we've needed to change our models to be capable of. But these are tweaks that we've had to make on the training side to make the product better and the application better.
I think you bring up a great point. When you look at different coding tasks, sometimes it's just refactoring, sometimes you are adding net new code, sometimes you are just extending the functionality by a little bit, the dependencies are all over the place. So what's the path to pre-training? So in this case, how often do you have to do it? Or rather, do you have to keep all these tasks in mind when you do pre-training? Or do you just say, hey, here's a whole bunch of code and here's a whole bunch of tasks, just take care of it? So how much do you go into each coding task, if you will?
So I think this is one of those things where having users is important, because we can realize what are the most common things that people actually care about. And, you know, like everything in the world, there's like this 80-20 distribution, right? Where 20% of the tasks account for 80% of the usage, right? So from that, we're able to very quickly learn, here are the objectives that we care about the most. And yeah, like we do want newer code all the time. We want newer code. We want to be able to be up to date. Some of this can be solved with retrieval, right? Like if you're within a bespoke code base, you probably want to use retrieval rather than train every hour, right? Train the model every hour. So there are different trade-offs that we try to think about. But yeah.
Yeah. In terms of interpreting the model, and if it's just autocomplete, meaning you're either giving me a line of code that I'll use or not, I can just accept it or reject it. I don't need to really understand what model you're using. But as the amount of code generated increases, meaning you're generating a block of code or maybe an entire file, you don't do it, but in general, this field is doing it. How do developers understand or trust the decisions made by an AI tool? Like, are there tools to debug AI logic? Or as you said earlier, that's not even the right path here. You should meet where the developers are, where they don't need to understand all the complicated architectures of the underlying AI models.
Yeah, I think it's probably beyond the scope of like most developers to just understand all the details. I think though, like one thing that should be clear is the stuff should be reviewed. If it's critical, you probably don't just automatically stamp and just say it's fine. And one of the things that we commonly say is like, don't get rid of your CI/CD pipelines and your security pipelines. Like actually validate that the security of these systems is high and continue to use the same deterministic systems. And these models will make the same kinds of mistakes humans do, right? So, I think probably don't need to understand the underlying details of how this works, but you shouldn't just take it for granted that these systems are perfect.
Right. And as you go to bigger and bigger companies, they might say that, hey, there's a starting point, it's a big model that does the work, but I want it to be specific to my context, meaning we've been writing our code for a couple of decades now. So how do you take an AI assistant and make it specific to the context of a large customer? And also too, does that even matter? Can the big AI model just say, hey, it doesn't matter, there's too much code that we used to train this, so your small code base of one company doesn't really matter? So how do you address this part of it?
Yeah, so I guess a couple of things that we actually do. So Dell has public case studies using the product, right? So very large companies currently use Codeium. I think we address it in two ways. So first of all, we actually enable the largest companies to potentially self-host the product if they don't want their code leaving the company. And this is like possible just because we actually do train our own models and have a stack that we run ourselves, right? Our company isn't wrapping like a bunch of other technologies, which is not bad, but that enables us to do that, right? And then the second thing is we offer a level of personalization that is like for the company that enables them to get the best experience possible for their code base. And that could be through the form of retrieval. That could also be because we, on the same piece of hardware, we enable companies to continuously fine tune the model too, by the way, on the same piece of hardware, right? So for us, we built infrastructure that actually is able to do this and tune the model to their private data. And this mostly is useful if they write bespoke languages. Right. Let's say they use a language or they do something that is completely unknown from what's happening in the open source. Like, don't expect if you write React like every other company for fine tuning to provide a lot of value. But in those cases, we're able to get that additional level of personalization to make sure that they're not just getting a cookie cutter product, but a product that is like tuned to them.
Right. And if you look at the security and privacy aspects of it, as you said, no matter what code is generated, you should still have your CI/CD pipelines. You do all your tests to make sure it meets your standards. But before that, when you release an AI coding assistant product, how do you assess the security and privacy standards of the code that's being generated?
Yeah, so I guess there's security and privacy in two ways, right? Like, is it leaving the company? How is it getting stored? What are the compliance? So we have a cloud product with SOC 2 compliance, zero data retention, and stuff like that. So that's one. Or we have a self-hosted product that you don't send anything anywhere. It doesn't, like, their code is like always resident where you are, which is what some companies' postures are in terms of code, which is totally reasonable given the way they think about code as some of their most important IP inside the company. When it comes to security being like the actual, if there are vulnerabilities in the code generated, comes back to what we discussed previously, which is that ultimately these systems are not going to be perfect. You can, what the kinds of things that we try to do is in our pre-training data set, we try to remove code that isn't, has known vulnerabilities, right? So if it has log4j issues or issues that are with very, very clear security issues, we don't put it into the data. But ultimately, there's probably real security bugs in even the Linux kernel, right? Which is maybe one of the most reviewed pieces of code. There are probably real security bugs there. People find security issues all the time. So if that's possible, these systems will have security issues.
Right. And also, as we see this subsector maturing, like more people will write code, the code generation will become easier. Do you think there's a risk of an increase in subpar software? Just because as it gets easier, more people will do it. And just because of that, the average might go down, because by definition, that's what happens here. So how do you think that plays out?
Yeah, my suspicion is that in this dimension, having people will be able to write more software. I think here's what's going to fundamentally happen. I think actually the capabilities to review software also get way better. And we might have some answers to this very soon, where you can actually AI-assisted review code in a way that is like, once again, you are validating the code, but you are able to validate it much more easily. And I think one of the things that's actually kind of interesting is, you know, if you look at some of the senior engineers or these quote unquote 10x engineers, they're actually, by the time if the company matures a lot and they have been at the company for a while, they're spending most of their time answering questions, reviewing code. And I suspect that actually what these tools are going to do is they're going to accelerate the capability for new hires and people that are more juniors to onboard onto a code base way more quickly. Answer their questions way more quickly, which is going to free up more time from the experienced developers that fundamentally want to write differentiated software. Right, they want to write applications that make the business better. And I actually think it will accelerate both of these aspects. Right, I don't think it's just going to be, we're going to get a lot of garbage and bloated code. I actually think the way around that is make it much easier to review code.
Right, that's a great point, actually. I think AI-assisted code generation is leading this movement. And then, AI-assisted code review will also kind of catch up. And that's a great point. Now, do you believe that in generative AI for coding, it will render certain programming languages or practices obsolete? If so, what are those corners that are at the risk of just becoming extinct?
So it's a good question. One of the things that I think is possible of why that could be more possible is generative, like these kinds of tools make the switching cost from one language to another a lot lower. Right, because the ability to recreate the app is much easier. All that being said and done, stuff like migrating from COBOL to Java is probably just very hard. And actually, there's a book on this, on just COBOL. The reason why this is so hard is some of these business applications that have been written in COBOL are so complex, have so much logic that just migrating it to COBOL to Java is just so error prone. I think the IRS tried to move their COBOL code base to Java and just spent over $1 billion and just couldn't do it in the end. Right. So maybe these kinds of tasks, albeit already kind of hard, like they will get easier. But one thing I don't believe is that there's going to be fewer developers and you know, this is going to take jobs away from developers. Like I'm firmly against that belief, just because what happened when we moved from people writing assembly to people writing Python? There were more developers because more people can write Python and more people that have ideas are actually able to execute on them, right? And people that already know and understand computers deeply are more leveraged. Right. And I think we are clearly in a world that is software starved. You go to a big company that spends 20% of their revenue, 10% of their revenue on R&D and software, and you ask them, look, would you rather fire a bunch of your developers or do more with your existing developers? All of the CIOs in the company will say the latter. They will not say the former. Right. So
earlier you mentioned edge cases or like less common scenarios. How does an AI coding assistant handle these edge cases? Obviously, it's not life or death like in like a autonomous car, but it is pretty important when you're shipping production software. So how do you handle edge cases here?
Yeah. And what do you mean by edge cases? Like just bugs in software?
Edge cases in the sense that you encounter a customer who's doing something that is just not in the defined area of what a coding assistant will do. So will it just say, hey, this, I just don't know how to autocomplete this, you figure it out? Or like how do you handle things that you haven't seen before?
Oh, I see. I got what you're saying. So two things. So these models hallucinate for a couple of reasons. They hallucinate partially because if you look at the internet and just the web, the amount of times people say, I know, for things that they don't know is way higher than the amount of times people say, like, I have no idea, given a question, right? So people are way more confident when they write things than when they're speaking in person and all this other stuff, right? So these models, generically speaking, if they don't know the answer, they'll make something up. Now, what you can do is there are ways in which you can tune these products, and we've done this for autocomplete, where if the model thinks that it's a low probability sequence, you just don't show it, right? Or you show it and tell people that it is. And you know, you could do other things where you can make it so that you have a preference or reward model that rewards a model, and this is for stuff like chat, that says I don't know when it clearly doesn't know, right? And you can actually make it do these kinds of things, and we've actually invested time in making sure that, look, like, for instance, when you chat with your code base, sometimes it'll just hallucinate, I saw this in your code base, and just if the context doesn't support the assertion that it made, just say I don't know, I don't really know. Right? And default to that. Now, the problem is you don't want to get into a state of what these other systems, I think Anthropic released a model for Claude 2 at that point. I've yet to see if Claude 3 is a big improvement on this dimension, where it'll just reject responding to you. It'll just be like, sorry, I cannot respond because I believe that this is a threat. And there's a fine line here where you know, it's paralysis. You're not completely paralyzing your model to not do anything. And then also at the same time, like being confident when it should be, and then saying, I don't know when it doesn't. Right.
If you look at the impact of generative AI on coding over the next 5 years, there's so many dimensions in which it's doing a good job. It's bringing in more people who can now write code. It's increasing the speed of iteration, the amount of code that gets shipped, the number of times you can test. So along all these dimensions, where do you think the biggest impact will be? And this is your personal view. Like, where do you think it's going to do a phenomenal job?
Is this in coding or is this outside of coding?
No, for coding. Gen AI for coding. Is it about bringing more people in, speed of iteration, amount of code generated? What's going to be the biggest impact?
I said a lot of things about agents. I believe that some form of agents that are controllable are going to be materially important in the next like 5 years. I think, you know, I try to do this thing where, because I was in autonomous vehicles, where, look, the technology is always getting better. It's always getting better. And, you know, I'll draw a couple of analogies there. When I was in AV, every year, the next year, we would have had AV. And clearly we didn't, right? Like, I was out of company for 4 years. And in reality, like, ultimately, large-scale AV was not, still yet to be deployed. But the trade-off is, in the meantime, actually, the technology curve got way better. Like, consumer-grade GPUs went from 10 teraflops in 2018 to 660 by the end of 2022. So they went up by two orders of magnitude. The amount of compute per GPU has gone up. Right. So from that perspective alone, the capability of the models will increase. That means that the frontier of what's feasible and what applications are able to be built will be higher. That means that the capability for us to get closer and closer to autonomously generating a PR is going to be very high. Are we going to be autonomously generating all the PRs that really exist? I find that a little bit hard to believe, just because even at the largest companies, how do you, like, the tools necessary to execute code, to the containers necessary, the bespoke environment, the tools that it needs to get access to. It's just a lot of things need to come together for that to be the case. But I think in certain specific ODDs or operating domains of writing software, we will be getting closer and closer to autonomy. I don't think we're there yet now, but I see that as a possibility.
Right. One last question before we go to the rapid fire round. And it's about the technological breakthroughs in generative AI. So if you look at this field of all the things that are happening specifically to enable coding tasks, like, what technological breakthrough are you most excited by in terms of what it can unlock for you and Codeium?
Yeah. So I think there are two key things that are going to be huge. Model scaling and more reasoning is going to be good. This makes the capability of these models hallucinate less. It can do larger scale tasks more reliably, right? Because of, once again, if the quality is not high enough, it doesn't matter that you have something that's like kind of good. It's just not going to be good enough to work. The second thing is being able to munge and consume as much context as possible is going to be the other key piece. Like, what are the techniques necessary to actually like be able to understand incredibly large data sets? Right? That's going to be the two key aspects, because ultimately when you look at a software engineer, they have, and the code bases they operate on top of, some of them are a billion tokens, right? That's like a far, that's far by way larger than what we're seeing right now. So I think both of these in conjunction will get us way further along on the, just the basic technology curve, right?
All right. That's amazing. All right. We're at the rapid fire round. I'll ask a series of questions and would love to hear your answers in 15 seconds or less. You ready?
Yep.
All right. Question number one, what's your favorite book?
Idea Factory. It's this book about Bell Labs and how they came up with ideas and during World War II and stuff like that.
Amazing. Next question. What has been an important but overlooked AI trend in the last 12 months?
Probably still the impact of scaling and more data and high quality data. I think there's a lot of other things that people are talking about, but not enough talked about that.
What's the one thing about AI coding assistants that most people don't get?
You can't build a product that does multi-step agent behavior if the first step doesn't work reliably already.
What separates great AI products from the merely good ones?
Those three factors. They hit the sweet spot of latency, quality, and correctability.
What have you changed your mind on recently?
I guess the speed at which GPUs are going to improve. I think they will improve actually faster. Looking at things like Grok, I think there's a lot of competition in the space, and that's going to be awesome for the entire category.
Yeah, I agree with that one. What's your wildest AI prediction for the next 12 months?
I think the way in which video and media consumption happens could change markedly, and it's pretty impressive to see what things like Sora are capable of doing.
All right, final question. What's your number one advice to founders who are starting out today?
Focus on building a product that people actually want today rather than a demo. I think it's possibly easy to get hype on a demo, but ultimately you got to build this company, and a company doesn't work if it's really just a demo.
Yeah, that's amazing. Warren, this has been a brilliant discussion. Like, love the sharp opinions, and it's always nice when somebody kind of, you have thought things through, you have an opinion, and you're presenting it. It's always nice. So thank you so much for coming onto the show and sharing your insights.
Thanks a lot, Prateek.
What a brilliant discussion on AI coding assistants. Thanks to Varun for coming onto the show. You can visit infinitemachinelearning.com to listen to all the other episodes. Thanks again for tuning in. I'll see you soon.